Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
We kick things off at the Pierre Hotel this morning with Michael Holland. He's the chairman of Holland & Company and the president and founder of the Holland Balance Fund. Great to have you with us. Great to see you.
Great to be here. Thanks for the coffee, Dan.
There you go. It is good, I must say. Let's start with the news from yesterday, the Prime Minister's speech and sort of what you saw there, what you heard there from the Prime Minister, how you're processing the formal start of Brexit as an investor.
The beginning of a two-year slog for her. I mean, it's going to be a very difficult. And the Scots have made her life even more interesting with their recent shenanigans. So, I think for us, we tend to look at the real world, and the numbers coming out of the UK, David, right now continue to be for companies better than expected. So this is a wonderful. We could have the market in the UK going up while we're all wringing our hands about what a job she has to do. Meanwhile, the companies are doing okay.
On the issue of uncertainty, she stuck to the timetable that she set out to stick to early on. Does that give you more optimism that these next 2 years are going to proceed at pace, that she's going to be able to stick to schedule, that these negotiations will take 2 years and will be finished by the end?
I think it's potentially a continuing mess, but I think she is a wonderful person to be because she seems resolute, as you just described. I think she's got an opportunity to surprise to the upside because we all expect a mess.
You look at the overtures in that speech to Europe. What do they portend for you? She's talked about the relationship that they have had, indeed, that she wants to have going forward. A lot of happy talk there. Where are the problems going to arise, as you see it, when it comes to the issues of trade and security?
Well, trade and security, I think trade is the key issue. And the security thing is what drove the voters, I presume, in the U.K. On the issue of trade, I think that if we don't get crazies on the EU side trying to punish the UK, trying to say to the remaining members who might be wavering a little bit, don't even think about it because look what we did to the UK. If those people have any important impact on what's going on, then it could get messier than we. But I think that at the end of this process, we will look back and say a lot of the pragmatists did get involved. I hope that's the case.
You mentioned the data a moment ago, and I wonder what accounts for it as you see it. The fact that there was such pessimism going into the vote, in the immediate aftermath of that vote, that the economy would go south. You look at sterling, I guess that's the exception, but it seems like the economy has fared better than many people thought. Why do you think that's the case?
You know, it's interesting. I'm seeing a simultaneous thing in three places. The U.S., the last couple of quarters, just met with our people who do our China investing and talking about the companies. Things are better in China than people have been expecting, and things are better in the U.K., as you said, and kind of broadly across Europe. So this is a worldwide phenomenon. It's not just there. And we were told time and again ad nauseum that if Trump got into office, you know, this whole stock market thing and the economy would go into the dump. That didn't happen here. We heard that Brexit was going to kill the UK and kill the markets. None of these happened. So I think that one of the things that is going on is the absence of the negatives is helping people do the animal spirits game a little bit.
How do you balance political risk at this point? You have it here with tax reform, the prospect for tax reform, the prospect for infrastructure spending. You have it overseas with these elections coming up in France. How much weight are you giving that versus, say, what central banks are doing?
I'm going to give you a little advertisement here.
Please.
Because if you look at Bloomberg this morning, there are a number of articles that refer to just that question, which includes the observation that things have gone better, as I just said a second ago, with respect particularly to the markets, but also with the fundamentals. Economic fundamentals, company fundamentals. So as we're moving forward here, things are moving apace. Earnings look to be surprising a little bit to the upside around the world, but starting with the U.S. and the numbers we're about to get. And I think that what's going on is the fundamentals are good, so they have been trumping pun intended. They have been trumping the political worries, and we were supposed to get all of these bad things happening politically, affecting the markets, and the bad stuff didn't happen to the markets. And I think it feeds on itself then.
What's your counsel to an investor who is preoccupied by the politics? How much should he or she be paying attention to the politics versus the fundamentals?
If my wife is listening, I'd say,
hello, if you are, yes.
You should spend no time, yep. You know, but I think very little time. I think to the extent that we get some positive things, for example, we now are talking about tax reform in the U.S. If we get corporate tax reform of some kind over the next 6 months, I think that will help the market somewhat. It'll help. But I think at this time we have companies and individuals feeling a little bit better about things, so numbers are continuing to surprise a little bit to the upside. If Washington doesn't screw that up, that's a big bet, but if they don't, that's a good thing. But even if they do screw it up, it hasn't been enough to derail what's going on around the world.
Have the contours of your portfolio changed much over these last few months since the election, say?
No. Interesting question, because I think there's been a bit of a rising tide lifting all the boats, but I think the best companies are continuing to figure out ways. That's a seminal question, because the best companies, the GEs and so on, around the Johnson & Johnsons, the Microsofts, the world's great companies have figured out that we'll be able to survive globally if we just continue to do smart things, and in incorporating the challenges from what may happen in the various countries around the world and their political miasma.
You mentioned you met with these Chinese fund managers, and I wonder what they said about the investment landscape in China, the appetite for investing. How has that changed in recent times?
They have some of the same malady we have here, which is the flows that are continuing to grow from the ETFs. So that means that the large companies, which are part of the index programs that the ETFs are involved in, that they end up with the wind at their backs. So the small and medium-sized companies in the emerging markets, beginning with China, are being a little bit ignored. So there's a growing opportunity. That's what we're hearing. But the companies overall are doing a little bit better than people suspected. And the numbers for the coming quarter and the coming year look to be, once again, a little bit better than suspected.
How do you go about finding companies in which to invest in China? What's your, is the metric different there than it is here or in Europe?
I don't even try.
Uh-huh.
And what we do try to do is find the smartest people on the ground in Shanghai, Beijing, Hong Kong, who visit all the places around China and the greater China area. And you have to do it. You have to look at these people face to face and talk about what is actually going on in their businesses. And that, for me, we've been doing this. We launched the China Fund, which we're talking about, actually, over 20 years ago. And so I've seen major changes, and we've made some mistakes, but overall the record is what it is. It's really good, and made a lot of money over there. But we've done it by having people on the ground spending all their time going visiting companies and seeing what's going on.
Do you find the economy to be more transparent, the communications about the economy to be more transparent now versus 20 years ago? Are they getting better at it?
Did you say less opaque?
Less either opaque? Or the glass empty or full, yeah.
Yeah, they are less opaque. But that's a key point, and it buttresses what I was just talking about in terms of you have to go talk to the people and see if they're lying to you.
Just maybe a last question here before, but we'll have you come back here after break. You mentioned the ETF funds. Let's talk about that when you come back. But we saw such a big news out of BlackRock yesterday. How important is it? And again, we'll come back and talk more about it.
Really important. Good to talk about. Great tease.
And part of it, but part of a trend. You see it. I mean, it's a part of a continuum here.
Major trend. All the listeners should pay attention.
All right. We'll come back and talk about that with Michael Holland. He's the chairman of Holland & Company, the president and founder of the Holland Balance Fund. He's with us here at the Pier Hotel for our Wheels Up Power Breakfast at the Pier. David Gura and Tom Keene here in New York and worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. David Gura and Tom Keene at the Wheels Up Power Breakfast at the Pier Hotel on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. Today we're here with Michael Holland, the chairman of Holland & Company, the president and founder of the Holland Balance Fund. Great to have you with us. We teased this before break. We were talking about the BlackRock news, and BlackRock deciding yesterday it's going to let go of about 30 people of its active equities group, and wanted to go to you for some perspective on that, the importance of that. We, of course, saw the news out of Fidelity a few weeks ago that they're going to do buyouts of some 3,000 people. Talk about this trend that's shaping up here and what that means for the industry generally.
Let me add a third, David.
Please.
T. Rowe Price a week ago talking about robo-investing. I thought of the three, the most interesting of them was T. Rowe Price, which had a long history of very successful active management. The people there over the years have done a spectacular job on a number of fronts, and yet they are part of this movement toward computers, internet, and artificial intelligence. I think it's not a cyclical thing. I think it's secular. I think that the numbers are very difficult to ignore in terms of particularly the efficient large cap markets around the world, starting with the U.S., so that when you have, as BlackRock did, money managers who are paid a lot of money to manage large cap stocks, and the ETFs that across the aisle that they have, which are index funds, which have very little in the way of expenses associated with them, and they can charge very little to the consumer, it's a no-brainer. So that's going to continue. It's too obvious.
Larry Fink yesterday spoke about changing the ecosystem, and that implies, to my ear at least, some agency. That he's going to be able to do so. Is BlackRock behind here? Are these companies behind a trend, or are they going to be able to catch up, do you think?
Well, I think they'll catch up. I think, you know, there's a lot of money to be made or lost, and I think they will move very quickly. Larry Fink has hired some very high-powered internet kinds of people over the last couple of years, and I think they're fully prepared to win this game.
Yeah. Good morning, everyone. Tom Keene here with David Gura. Wheels Up Power Breakfast getting ready. This is a good chore for you. They think we've convinced the producers of this wonderful entertainment vehicle that it's a chore for us to come to the Pierre Hotel.
No, we get to leave the building. We get to walk, and yeah, no, but you're right.
Got fresh air, beautiful spring morning.
Free
great
coffee.
Food here, wonderful hospitality,
yes.
An elegant breakfast and venue. Even Michael Hollins showed up for a bit. Michael, help me here with robo-investing. That's not in Graham Dodd-Cottle. I don't even think it's in Jack Bogle. Would you please explain what robo-investing is?
It's just one more facet of using computers to help make money for individual investors, Tom. And I think that it is simply a way of eliminating the potential screw-ups that we humans can do and eliminating the fees that we humans can charge for those mistakes. That's really important because a lot of times you end up with a high-priced product that is an inferior product.
I'm going to go inner Princeton on you here, Harvard guy, and ask you what Jack Bogle would say. At 4 cents, at 0.4%, at 0.7%, how can you afford to do anything with computers with the fee battle that's going on?
Well, I think what's going to happen is we will have a continuing migration for a lot of investors, which has begun several years ago and is picking up steam over the last couple of years, where people are realizing in a 2% world, we were talking a little while ago in the market check, we have a 2% world if you look across the fixed income markets. You can't ignore the fees the way we used to when we had a 10 and 15% return world.
What do you say to somebody who's nearing graduation from college or graduate school, thinking about getting into this business? How radically has it changed? Is it changing? And what kind of jobs are going to exist for somebody who's interested in getting into investing?
So, for the young people who are listening, Dave, that's a really important question. To go to the traditional stuff in Wall Street, as their uncles or their parents might have done, doesn't make a lot of sense without going the extra step and acknowledging what we're just talking about, which is you better have your computer skills way up there and incorporate that in how you approach this business in the future. Michael Bloomberg is one of the best people to think about. You know, he changed the business. The business is changing again.
He changed the business. Well, we're going to run out of time here. We should mention that Mr. Bloomberg is principal owner of Bloomberg LP and has a modest interest in this radio station. And well, Michael, we've got to have you come back here to talk about this, about the changes in the business, because the sequence, as you mentioned, David, the number of announcements, including T. Rowe Price, has been absolutely extraordinary. David Gura and Tom Keene, we're beginning a good number of hours here at our Wheels Up Power Breakfast, a Pierre Hotel. This has become a wonderful part of our Thursdays at Bloomberg to be here. Is Megan Murphy going to be with us?
I see her over yonder.
She's like entered the room. Next from Bloomberg Business Week, Megan Murphy. This is Bloomberg. Why don't you bring in a gentleman who's the only one here at the Pierre Hotel who knows what a white paper is.
There you go. Get his thoughts on that just a moment. Ian Harnett joins us now. He's the chief investment strategist and co-founder at ASR, as you said, joining us here at the Pierre. And I want you to play a spectral veterinarian here at the top. Give us your sense of the health of the animal spirits, your read on the role they're playing right now.
So I think that, you know, the thing that we're concerned about is that all this soft data, the animal spirits, you know, this is all about U.S. consumers and the U.S. corporate effectively having mentally spent those tax cuts. The trouble is that the hope of that fiscal easing is going to confront the reality of the monetary tightening that has already taken place. You know, we don't need another rate rise to drag that, you know, even further. Short rates are up, long rates are up, and the dollar is up over the last 6 months. And in the past, that tends to drag down economic growth. So, you know, the hard data, we can see that it's actually really struggling when you look at retail sales, auto sales, housing sales, you know, anything that's stuff is actually finding it hard to deliver. And, you know, that's going to be the reality. And you look at the money supply data as well, C&I loan growth, that's all decelerating. You know, so I think it's, we've got a lot of hope there.
Do you see how Ian Hartnett's having tea here at the
Pierre
Hotel?
I'm a Brit. I'm a Brit. You know, wouldn't you just expect that?
We're putting down triple espressos, and he has tea.
Much more refined. I mentioned Tobias Lefkowitz, who is our guest here earlier in the week, and his comments on the fact that the soft data, to his eye at least, is indicating what's to come for the economy. A lot of people very happy with the optimism expressed in those data. What are you seeing?
Well, you know, I think if you look back in the history, you can see the way that soft data does normally lead the hard data, but it leads by about 2 to 3 months. So if it looks like 2009, the soft data took off and then the real data picked up. But 2013, the soft data picked up and then had to come down and meet the reality.
I want you to help our listeners with a concept that's really hard to get a handle on. Atlanta does this with their WUJI index, which is if things outside of central banks become more tighter, strong dollars, mentioned, how does that be equivalent to a rate rise? Where you guys say this happened, that happened, and it's like two equivalent rate increases. What did translate that?
You know, so what you're trying to do there is to see whether it is what's going to impact the corporate sector, what's going to impact the household sector. And when we look back in the past, we can see that those periods of strong US dollar growth, you know, so look back to the early 1980s, you know, how much was that equivalent to in terms of holding down the earnings growth, holding down economic activity? And as you saw between 1982 and 1985, you know, that 30% rise in the dollar actually led to 3 years of negative earnings growth, weak economic activity, and unemployment going up from 8% to 11%, Tom. So, you know, you're trying to see how much mentally, you know, that you could have done.
Okay.
If you'd have had to have raised short rates or long rates, what would have been the equivalent number?
So here's the unfair Thursday question. Where are we on Taylor rule equivalency yet? If Taylor rule is this pure monetary model, with all this other stuff going on, have we really closed the gap on John B. Taylor's model?
So on our models, yes, the Taylor rule is pretty close to being where you are. But if you look at the shadow rates that you were talking about, we've actually seen a 4% rise in those shadow rates over the last 3 years. Now, you know, if the economy is close to the you know, neutral point, you know, our worry is that actually you shouldn't be tightening too much further. We only think you're going to get one more rate rise out of the Fed this year.
So this is critical. Can we end the end of the year as we go into tax reform and all this other mystery stuff restrictive, where we have a restrictive policy?
You know, our worry is that if you don't get that fiscal expansion coming through, then, you're going to see, you know, the economy actually slowing down. We know that this is close to the peak of the inflation cycle as well, and that at that point, the Fed's going to find it very difficult. So this is why we think the Fed's going to put that second rate rise in May, but it's going to find it very difficult to push through for a third or a fourth in the second half of the year because they don't want to be too restrictive. They will be data dependent, which is coming back to what Tom was saying before the break.
We get these GDP data short. shortly at 8:30 Wall Street time. How do you regard GDP? What does it tell you about the economy? How much credence do you give?
Kathleen Hayes says it's noisy.
Yeah, it's noisy. It's backward-looking. So I think you've got to take it with a pinch of salt. You've got to look at the broad trend in data. What's the monetary data saying? What's the economic data, you know, the real economy data? And what's the financial market saying? Now, I think my worry is that when you look at things like financial conditions, they're actually telling you more about the equity market, the credit market, and they are discounting a big rise in investment. And the big challenge is, can you get that investment coming through without the tax cuts?
You know, on the subject of tax cuts, I was poring over your note, and the line stood out to me. It said, changes to corporate tax could prove disruptive both within the U.S. and overseas. I don't think this is something we've talked about enough. We've talked about the potential for it. There seems to be enthusiasm for changing the tax code, but we haven't talked about the disruptiveness of it.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, how the corporate sector deals with that, I think the big risk here is that because of that first-year tax deductibility of investment, you know, the why would you do investment now if you think there might be a tax code change, you know, in 6 months' time or 3 months' time, and if that gets pushed back again, you know, so our worry is that you get this disappointment about investment coming through in the second half of the year. Yeah, there'll be some energy-related capex coming through, but will broader capex actually improve? And if that doesn't happen, and at the same time Chinese growth is slowing, then the pressure for the global economy to actually disappoint, and you're certainly not to get to Mr. Bullard's new regime, you know, that's the...
What's fascinating here is there's another side of the debate of the many people we speak to, which is even if the U.S. stumbles or is tepid or is average, there's a global improvement going on. I believe your notes suggest you don't agree.
Yeah, no, you know, so there was a global improvement going on. You know, we believe that there's been a cyclical Asian inventory story that has been driving the bulk of the improvement, both in the real economy, but also in the markets as well. Now, our worry is that if that was driven by Asia, if that was driven by the Chinese stimulus that we saw at the start of last year and through to the middle of last year, and that is starting to wane, that actually that inventory is shortage is now being replaced. Wow. We're seeing the pickup in shipments, and that takes some of these pressures off,
okay.
Takes the pricing pressures off, takes the air freight pressure off.
Well, not that you're the most cynical person at the Pier Hotel. I got that award this morning.
Always.
But are you saying the Chinese goosed their economy to get to the political congresses? And now, just like in America, frankly, after the election, oops, and there's a little bit of a tepid,
I'd be even more cynical than that, Tom, which is that they goosed it so much that actually they don't want to tell you how much they goosed it. So on our Chinese tracker, we think Chinese growth is running at 8.5%. But, you know, nobody wants to tell President Trump that they're growing at 8.5% when the U.S. is growing at, you know, potentially 1% that we might hear this morning. So, you know, from that point of view, when you look at Shanghai house prices up 20-odd%, Beijing house prices up 20-odd%, much more consistent with an even stronger number than the 6.5 type 6.9 numbers that they're printing. You know, so they can afford to see the economy decelerate going into the plenum. And then if it weakens through 6.5%, they'll turn on the spigot once again.
You do this show, and by Thursday, you can pick up on the themes of the week.
Yeah.
And C&I loans is something that's come up over and over again.
Yeah.
What do you see there? What should our listeners take note of in C&I loans?
Yeah, well, I think what it highlights is that actually the corporate sector is quite extended. And as you see the expectation of rate rises coming through, well, why would you want to increase your exposure to debt? Debt levels are already quite high. They're back to 1990 type levels as looking at the bottom up data relative to sales. Even interest costs are relatively high given how low interest rates are. So, you know, the expectation of higher rates is never great for monetary aggregates.
To me, it's just, well, let's come back. Ian Hertner with us, with ASR, with the course's work, particularly out of Europe, and we'll come back with Dr. Hartnett to advance the conversation forward. Not only, I guess we could talk Brexit.
We could talk
the United Kingdom.
News item.
I just wish Americans could speak like Prime Minister May. I don't mean the content. I don't want to editorialize it, but what it was Churchillian. Would you suggest, David?
She understood the import of the moment.
She almost knew the details.
Almost knew the details.
I didn't editorialize
that well.
I didn't want to say that. We do go nerdy once a week. We're going to do that right now with Ian Hartnett of ASR Research. This is a real treat, folks. This is what Bloomberg Surveillance is about. Many of you know the name Robert Engel of New York University and Clive Granger, the laureates who've been with us. Ian Hartnett studied in the same milieu under David Henry at Oxford years ago.
Yeah.
And the world is a world of mathematics and error and probability and managing mistakes. I would suggest there is a massive distrust of a large part of the audience, including the President of the United States, in using economic data. That epsilon in the back of the equations, how bad is it right now, and is it bad because of the great distortion?
Well, I think that, you know, what you've got is a situation where, you know, the economics profession needs to regain the trust of society. You know, our view is that actually part of the problem with society, you know, and the some of the issues that we've seen in Brexit and here in the United States is that actually, you know, economics hasn't served society well. And, you know, what we need to get back to is actually making sure that the data is accurate and
right.
that the views are more appropriate.
But critical, going to William Sharp of Stanford University.
Yep.
Michael Holland was with us earlier, and we all know that there is a distortion in the investment sphere
yeah.
because of totally unnatural nominal and real rates.
Yeah.
Is that same distortion in Chair Yellen's economics because she doesn't have a real fixed income market to work with?
Well, you know, I think that yeah, but with this isn't in a way the first time that we've had this. We had very low interest
Agreed.
Rates in the past, you know, and I would argue that, you know, when you go back to the First World War and the Second World War, we actually had a quantum of negativity about what was required to get those debt-to-GDP ratios down. First World War, needed to see minus 10 real rates, and it took 5 years to get back to real rates being normalized. You know, post-World War II, you had to go to minus 5, and it took 10 years. Now, I think one of the problems is that actually by limiting real interest rates, sorry, nerdy, yeah, you said it was going to be a nerdy section, by limiting real interest rates because of that 2% inflation target that we've got around the world to minus 2, you've actually slowed this process. So I think that's the big problem, that the inflation targeting has caused some of the problem
right.
that we've got here, and that's one of the issues that we need to overcome.
Right.
We need more flexibility, not less.
And David, this alludes to Marvin Goodfriend's Jackson Hole paper and the raging debate of how to push real and even nominal rates lower.
Let me ask you about the speech we heard yeah. yesterday from the Prime Minister. We were having a conversation with Michael Holland a little earlier, as Tom mentioned, and he was painting a rosy picture of the UK economy, that things have gone better than many expected in the wake of that vote. She set a timetable. She stuck to the timetable at least as much as she could. What does that say about where we're going to go from here?
Well, I think, you know, let's go to two things. First of all, so far it's been a phony war. And the key thing is that the Bank of England stepped in on day one and they said, you know, we will give you the liquidity that you need. Please use our currency to drive that lower. And it's that currency weakness that has provided the insulation here. You choose how you want to take your medicine. And, you know, the bank said, let's take it through the weak exchange rate. A bit like Italy did in the 1990s. The UK is becoming the Italy of Europe once again. You know, it's and you should have a discount for that. Going forward, you know, what I would say is that our headline in our research is taken from the Irish Times the day that Theresa May announced her 10-point plan. Everybody has a plan until they're punched in the face. The Mike Tyson. This is the European view of what they are going to do to the UK. It is not going to end well. It's going to be hard Brexit. It's going to be chaotic Brexit. And we are going to end up with WTO rules. And, you know, we're going to need currency weakness to offset some of those harsh realities.
How did Prime Minister May's remarks echo off the stone buildings on Threadneedle Street yesterday? How is Mark Carney and his colleagues going to interpret what she had to say?
You know, well, I think Mr. Carney has shown very clearly that the Bank of England is very, you know, remember that they want to get inflation up. They want to have, you know, they're prepared for a short-term boost to inflation. You know, that's what central banks have been trying to do. You know, I think they will get worried if we see inflation carry on above 3% for a number of years. But, you know, because what's happening is a real income is being compressed. At the moment, UK consumers are overcoming that because they're saving less. They're seeing their utility bills go up, but they still want to go on holiday, so they're borrowing some more and they're saving less. But you can't do that forever, and that's when the problem starts to arrive.
What is the constraint of tax reform from debt to GDP? There's any number of ways of measuring this. The way I measure it is it's over a double from the debt to GDP of Ronald Reagan.
So I'm less concerned. I think Japan tells us that the level of GDP can be coped with for a period of time. What happens is about debt sustainability. And so if global growth slows, if US growth slows, if UK growth slows, then your debt limits become, you know, really binding. You know, it's if you've got nominal growth, you can get out of it. But remember, the lesson of history, Tom, is that the creditor always pays. And there's only three ways of getting out of debt: default, debase, or devalue.
And this is, Joe Stiglitz has been way out front of this. And this, David Gurrow, to finish with a nerd fest, is the little gene. And unfortunately, Ian Hartnett has to leave, because if he stayed around, we'd have to go to logs.
We'd have to go to logs.
We don't want to go to logs.
I think we set a record for laureate mentions in that segment.
I think
there were more than five.
Well, that's so.
There was, I think, 2003, we had like an eight laureate
section.
Ian Hartnett, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. Great to see you. Thank you, David.
Absolute Strategy Research, greatly appreciate this morning. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC. It has been far too long since we spoke to Ian Bremmer of Eurasia Group. Dr. Bremmer changed the dialogue of international relations with any number of phrases, including this interesting world we live in now, which has a very G0 feel with it. Ian Bremmer, good morning.
Hey, good morning to you guys. Tom, good to be with you.
Ian, I saw yesterday the greatest juxtaposition in international relations I've ever seen: the eloquence, the fire, the passion of Prime Minister May's speech, and then the leaden silence of the European response in Brussels. How's this going to play out? Was the body language we saw yesterday indicative of how ugly this Brexit debate's going to be?
Well, I mean, I think one thing I'd say is that while Theresa May has done as good of a job as could be possibly expected to get the UK looking like a unified actor, that's going to be impossible to keep up. And you'll see that with the Great Repeal Bill and challenges from Parliament now that they've actually triggered Article 50 to what it's going to look like, what that actually is going to look like, you know, problems within the Tory party, problems from Labour and in opposition, and also, of course, problems from the Scots who want to move ahead with a second referendum. So the pressure is both internal on both sides for May. And, of course, the Europeans also facing a French election if Le Pen actually wins, which is a possibility. The idea that you're going to have a constructive Brexit negotiation is effectively zero. Even if that's not the case, it's hard to imagine that this is going to be smooth sailing from a very deeply politically dysfunctional EU and their member states. So lots of economic reasons why we should have a good and functional Brexit deal between the EU and the UK. Every political reason to believe that they will not be able to get their houses in order.
You know, as I was listening to Donald Tusk yesterday deliver that statement, I don't think I'd call it a speech, Tom. I think it was more of him reading a statement on what had happened. He talked about the unified European Union. He and the 27 members would be approaching this in a united front. How confident are you that that's going to happen? How much unification are we seeing here among those ranks?
I'm completely confident that there's no such thing as a unified approach among the Europeans. And again, keep in mind, this is going to be done over 2 years. All of these countries have their own electoral cycles. They have a lot of domestic elements to play for. You already saw this with President Hollande saying that modalities need to be agreed to before you can start the actual substance of those negotiations. Very different from the position that Tusk and Theresa May take right now. Now, you can say, well, Hollande is a lame duck because he's about to lose the elections. Well, precisely. And over the course of the next 2 years, you're going to have a large number of heads of state, elected leaders, and want to be elected leaders across Europe that are going to do their part to score points domestically, irrespective of what damage that happens to cause to the Brexit negotiation process. That is not their problem, but it will be, of course, the problem of those of us that hope that the UK deal can be smooth sailing.
Ian, illuminate us on the French election. I have the joy right now of reading Jonathan Fenby's wonderful one-volume France on this election. What is lost in translation in the reporting? If you look at the culture and fabric of France, what are we missing in the analysis?
I think there are two things. The first is that the French as a nation are easily as exceptionalist as the Americans are. The fact that Trump was elected, the fact that Geert Wilders did badly in the Netherlands, those things are not fundamentally affecting the way the French are thinking about their own elections. They're French. And so they'll go in with their own dynamic, and their own dynamic is deeply problematic. A president of the establishment whose approval ratings are literally in the toilet and is seen as particularly failing on migrant and security issues. Macron, certainly a charismatic person who is his outside the political establishment, but is neither left nor right, and so no one is super excited about him. So the second important dynamic is that turnout is absolutely key, and if not that many people vote, you guaranteed that the people that support Le Pen are going to be out there. Final point is that social media, Le Pen is killing it, doing vastly better as well as the issues she cares about than other candidates are. So I think there is a real possibility that Le Pen is the next president.
From the Eurasia Group prism, she has the ability to get a marginal voter, as did Mr. Trump.
That's exactly right.
Ian, secretaries of state collect frequent flyer miles like George Clooney's character in Up in the Air, usually. You can go to the State Department website and see how far they've flown. I look now at where Rex Tillerson's been. It's three places, maybe just under 20,000 miles here in his tenure thus far. He's headed to Turkey, headed to Brussels. What do you expect he's going to talk about there? Why Turkey? Why there right now?
That's right. He's getting neither the frequent flyer miles nor the ladies that George Clooney did when he traveled internationally. And looking at Rex, none of that should surprise anybody, right? He's up there age-wise, and he's already accomplished what he feels like he needs to accomplish. I mean, Hillary Clinton got all the miles, but she wanted to be president. She had something to prove. Rex does not have the relentlessness in terms of I'm going to work 24/7 to get a deal done that, let's say, John Kerry did around Iran. But he is an adult, and he knows a lot of these leaders well. I think he's going to do a lot better in parts of the world where he has experience. The fact that his first trip was Asia didn't help much because he really doesn't have any background there. But, you know, the Gulf states, the sub-Saharan Africa, Russia, East Europe, he's going to be much more comfortable, and he's going to be received extremely well. I think there was a lot that was made out of the fact that he didn't bring any media with him to that Asia trip, just one loyalist. Frankly, again, if you're Rex Tillerson, you don't have the same view of the utility of the media as someone like Kerry or Hillary Clinton, who were career politicians and know how these guys need to play. Yeah. The single thing that worries me the most is that Tillerson's direct access to Trump has been virtually zero. And I think that if that continues for the next six months, he's not going to stick in the position for long. He doesn't need this, and ultimately he's not going to be seen as marginalized or humiliated in the position.
Well, let's come back. Dr. Bremer with us this morning with Eurasia Group. And of course, excuse me, it's only one block. My fault. That was my mistake. I was somewhere between the eggs and the sausage at the Power Breakfast Pier Hotel, and I missed that cue. Dr. Bremer, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it. Ian Bremer of Eurasia Group. This is not the most important interview of the week, the day. This is at least the most important interview until you re-up your lease or redo your mortgage. Jonathan Miller joins us with Miller Samuel right now. I want to know, in the dynamics of the market nationwide, but in the big cities as well, the sanctuary cities, are the sellers coming down or are the buyers buying up? Which is it?
Oh, I think it's clearly the sellers are coming down, especially as you skew to the higher end of any housing market. There's been a lot of talk about the Trump bump, especially since the election, and there has been a noticeable uptick in activity. We're seeing, when I say noticeable, I don't mean huge. I just mean we can see an increase. But what we're really seeing, which is really interesting, is for every big transaction you read about in the news, in most cases, the seller came down, 20, 30, 35% off of the last asking price. And that's an important step in a market trying to heal itself.
Okay, but what about beneath the mega deals? It's not in the New York Post. I don't care about some umpteen gazillion dollar property. in the real world, what are prices doing?
In the real world, prices are moving sideways and even a little drifting a little bit lower. We're going to see, maybe a little bit more of an uptick in the next couple of quarters just because of the increase in activity. But inventory has been rising. So. You know, that keeps price growth in
you
check.
You don't know this. David Gura just re-upped in Brooklyn.
Yeah,
he got two free months rent and a boxcar of kale.
Right.
It was great. They wheeled that puppy right up to your house.
A boxcar. What's happening with the rental market here in Manhattan, here in Brooklyn? I mean, are prices going to continue to go up? Who's paying five figures for renting apartments here?
So both Manhattan and Brooklyn are doing just about the same thing. We've seen a tremendous influx of new product, and most of it has been skewed towards the higher end. So what we're seeing across all markets is we're seeing the price growth is cooling. The lower you go in price, the more likely prices are rising. I don't think anybody factored in during this new condo development boom in both in New York City that about a quarter of those buyers ended up being investors, and those investors go on the market and compete with these new developments. And one other thing is that we're seeing record landlord concessions. We continue to see that about a third of the market. Tenants are getting significant concessions from the landlord just because landlords are trying to keep the buildings full. And that seems to be working. Vacancy is not expanding. But I don't know how much longer, how much more they can offer before they really have to start cutting prices.
I was wandering around Wyeth Street in Williamsburg over the weekend in the shadow of these tall towers they've built on the water. I gather a lot of those are rentals. We hear what's going to happen with the L train. They're going to close it for 24 months, maybe.
Even 14 months,
maybe,
right?
There you go.
Yeah.
What does that mean for that neighborhood? What does that mean for people who are living there, renting there?
Well, I think it has much more of an impact on the rental market than the condo market, because condo, your period of ownership might be a decade. Rental, you're only... So I think it's going to really hurt the rents there. Rents are going to be very soft because the commute is going to become a lot more difficult. But you'll see rent... You'll see more rent pressure as, you know, they're going to... Those tenants are going to drift to other neighborhoods.
See, this is the difference. I'm trying to do a national show and worldwide to intrigue our audience.
We're on the East River.
David Gurus
looking for your next loft, Tom.
Two-block area directly down the street from where he lives. Jonathan Miller with us, with Miller Samuel. Help me here with the acquisition of a house. You've been so good over the years about saying, forget about all the mumbo-jumbo. You can't get a mortgage. Is it better now?
Credit conditions still remain. So it's not that it's better in the sense that mortgage credit has eased. What it is I just think the players are better at getting through the process or through the system. I think the best thing that can happen to, and it sounds counterintuitive, but I think that mortgage rates continue to be really way too low for credit to noticeably ease.
Yeah.
And so there is a trade-off between people that are payment-focused and how people feel about, next year with their job and whether they're going to get a promotion.
The question I get all the time, because somehow people think I'm a conduit to knowledge on this, is how much money down do you need? Whether it's a mere mortal property in a suburb of Boston or a condo in San Francisco or maybe in Washington, it's somebody trying to step up to live next door to Ivanka. How much money down do you need?
The standard default really is 20%.
It's still 20%.
But you can certainly, there are many options to get far less than that. It's just the more exceptions to the process, the more difficult the application is. It's kind of interesting. If you look at over the last decade, interest rates have essentially plunged, and mortgage origination has too. So that missing variable is really credit conditions.
That's interesting. So how closely are you watching the Fed? How worried are you about rates going up?
Well, after this last increase, the Yellen increase, we have rates sort of drifting lower. So I don't know if everybody buys into that rates are, because we keep talking if rates are going to continue to rise. The Fed may try to do that, but I'm very skeptical that mortgage rates are going to continue to rise, and we're going to have some kind of issue with that. And if they do, what's important to realize is that a decade ago, mortgage rates were 2% higher than they are now, and sales volume in a, I'm sorry to be specific to New York, sales volume was at an all-time record. So interest rates aren't the only piece to the housing puzzle.
What do you see nationally right now? I mean, I know you've got with Miller Samuel a huge New York bias, but you do a lot of other city work as well. Yeah. What's the distinction of your next memo?
So the big pattern that continues to evolve is that housing markets continue to be softest on top, whether we're talking about rental or purchase market. The West Coast is in a better position than the East Coast, that they're maybe later to the party. I'm not quite sure what the timing difference is. It's clearly California, the housing market there is a lot tighter than it is on the East Coast.
Are people on the fence about whether to rent or buy? Is there any solution to that argument?
Well, that's the age-old rent, because, you know, generally speaking, it's still a lot cheaper to buy. It's just the down payment is the getting through credit conditions. But I've said this in the past, over the last year and a half, you are seeing record sales activity in, again, sorry to be New York centric, but we're seeing this in other markets too. We are seeing record sales activity continue in the outlying suburban markets of New York City as renters priced out of the market are becoming first-time home buyers. The volume is multi-decade highs.
Don't be a stranger, Jonathan.
Yeah, good to see you.
Miller with Miller Samuel, of course, with his wonderful work on the countability. What's great about this, folks, and you don't see it within the interview, the backdrop of statistics that he has is jaw-dropping city to city, and particularly in the boroughs of New York City. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.